Okay, I'm ready.
Okay. Welcome to the MacGuffin Man. I'm Alex, and the other person who's ready to do this podcast is James. You can check out our website, MacGuffinMan.com, to keep up on our most recent podcasts. We most recently discussed The Killing, Bicycle Thieves, and Ace in the Hole. So yeah, you can check those out, MacGuffinMan.com.
Welcome to the MacGuffin Man. And now, here are Alex and James.
James.
Yeah, I didn't notice how much shady crime we've been into lately.
Yeah, well, I mean, but today we are at least returning to the world of color film.
That's true.
Which we've been away from for some time.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. We were talking about The Thin Blue Line.
Yes.
Boom, color right in the title.
Yeah.
That's how colorful this film is.
Yeah, exactly.
An Errol Morris documentary, director, I guess writer.
Yeah, I mean, if you are watching documentaries, the credits are always kind of bizarre, and I've never quite understood why some writers will take a writing credit for the documentary and some will just take a producing credit. I feel like Morris tends to take a producing credit, like produced and directed by, but I might be wrong about that, but I've never totally understood, because anytime you're directing a documentary, chances are you're writing and producing anyway. So who knows? You know, like, does conducting the interviews automatically make you a writer? I would argue yes. You know, does researching anything automatically make you a producer? I would also argue yes. So that's sort of my stance on documentary filmmaking in general. So I don't quite know what the credits are, but he's definitely the director, and that's the credit I care about the most anyway.
Yeah, and I mean, I know that you're kind of coming at this from a, you know, more of a contractual, you know, mm-hmm. behind the scenes Hollywood kind of angle of who gets what credit. But
yeah, he does have this, a written by credit, for the record.
This is just an interesting one because, I mean, not just Thin Blue Line in particular, but documentary is just a very different kind of film style than any other kind of film style, and he's not the kind of guiding voice that you get with Morgan Spurlock or Michael Moore, but it's, you know, it's still very much his, even though, I mean, I guess you do hear his voice near the end in that final interview, but yeah. His name's all over it, obviously, and for good reason, but, you know, you can kind of lose him in the shuffle while you're getting caught up in the story. But I think one of the big things that we're going to get to is exactly his role in shaping your opinion and not just shaping this film, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think as you get later into his career, Morris definitely does not shy away from his voice appearing in his films. I specifically remember in The Fog of War, there's an extended conversation where Morris is like kind of yelling because this is in a post-Interrotron world, and so he's a bit further away from his subject than he would have been when he's shooting a thin blue line, and it's just him and Robert McNamara like kind of yelling at each other, and it's just very, very entertaining, and Errol Morris just speaks in such an engaging way.
I'll quickly say Fog of War would have just been more personal because it was more things that he kind of watched happen and couldn't mm-hmm. control. Whereas this is a story he came to much later, or, you know, not when the story was done, because as a result of this film, you know, that story continued in a very important way. But this one he kind of stumbled upon while researching that Dr. Grigson character that we kind of come across in this film. But I imagine with Fog of War, which, if anyone doesn't know, is a movie about Robert McNamara and his involvement in the Vietnam War and a ton of other things about the foreign policy of the United States. I can just imagine that being something he has more things to say about. And maybe it's the confidence that comes with age and success as well.
Yeah, exactly. And I think, I mean, semi-famously, the shots of the tape recorder at the very end of The Thin Blue Line, they only had an audio recording of the interview because their camera broke that day. So I don't think Errol Morris ever intended for his voice to be in this movie. And I think at the time, if everything had gone, you know, like if the camera had worked that day, I think he would have tried to find a way to edit that sequence without his voice. I don't know how he would have done it, because the way that Harris talks in that sequence is makes it kind of difficult to edit into a coherent point, but also there are so many edits that happen throughout this movie that we don't even recognize, like, as a part of the skill of Morris and his team, that I just couldn't even imagine how he would have put it together. There are probably still edits in that tape being played. But anyway, like, I think the reception of this movie would probably have bolstered Morris to include himself more in his movies as time progressed and as he got older and was just like, oh, people don't care, I can throw my voice in there every once in a while, you know.
Yeah, and so it's interesting to talk about this as a product of its time, because cinema verite was kind of what was the hottest thing to do in documentary since I think the 60s, right? It was the very fly on the wall type of documentary, in that even though, as we say, you know, we don't see Errol Morris, we hear his voice only a little bit, and I agree with you, I think that that is something he very begrudgingly did after yelling at some people. He does stay out of it, but this is definitely not just, you know, found footage. These are interviews, these are staged interviews, with some, I would say, costuming and set design to kind of put your thumb on the scale a little bit. Mm-hmm. I don't think a lot of people disagree with that. And the reenactments that we get. So even though it's not him really putting his face out there and so clearly stating, this is what I believe, this is why I believe it, as sort of a video essay, he's kind of just behind the curtain pulling the strings, I think, is the way to look at this, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And the best way to describe it, the most simple way to describe it, is that he applies narrative filmmaking techniques to what is a documentary film. And that's where you're getting with those reenactments, the way the interviews are shot, as well as the way that the reenactments are shot. And the music is so cinematic.
Right.
And yeah, and I can't say I'm very well versed in the early days of documentary, but a lot of, like, I don't think shooting interviews was like a new thing, you know, shooting staged interviews. But what you're saying about verite and sort of that fly on the wall sort of idea, that you don't create anything, you just use the stuff that you have available to you, and then spice it up with interviews and stuff as best you can. You know, like the shots of newsprint that Morris does, totally reasonable and part of the rules of and a part of the rules of traditional documentary filmmaking. The shot of a Burger King malt flying through the air in this very stark, high contrast lighting, absolutely not, you know. And so yeah, I can't speak to documentary filmmaking history as well, because I just don't watch as many documentaries as I do fiction. And I think that's a huge reason why I'm very drawn to Morris's work, specifically this film. This is easily my favorite of his work. But all of the movies, I've seen about half of the movies he's made, if not more, and I love every one of them. There's just something about him and his style that I just find very, very appealing.
Yeah, and I guess it's the documentary form that is not this, is to just find me news clip, like news footage, you know, news reports from around this time. Let's find any archival footage of this act or whatever taking place.
Say, like, if you were to do a documentary about the JFK assassination, this is a Pruder film, obviously, and any sort of like archival footage that you can find of the president, you know, of President Kennedy, like those types of things is what you're describing. Or also there's the fly on the wall style documentary that the D.A. Pennebaker, Bob Dylan documentary. Is that Don't Look Back? I forget what that one's called. There's so many goddamn Bob Dylan documentaries.
Yeah, that's Don't Look
Yeah,
Back.
And No Direction Home is the Scorsese one.
Scorsese, yeah.
Yeah. Okay. But yeah, the Pennebaker style of, and the Maisels brothers were famous for this as well, following their subjects just closely. Yeah,
and they know that's going to be documentary footage. It's just that kind of stuff occupies so little time in this movie. Mm-hmm. We get a couple shots of newspaper clippings and zoomed up on that. And other than that, it's these interviews. And then I was curious about your opinion on, what is it, Emily Miller? Is that her name? The one who comes in late to say that she and her boyfriend witnessed the shooting?
She's intriguing. I mean, I don't believe her, but also...
Oh, no, sorry. More specifically, I just wanted to make sure that was the right character.
I'm not 100% sure. I will... names are tricky because one of my favorite things that Morris does, and the thing that really the first time I watched this movie was like, oh my god, this is such a cool idea, is that there just aren't like name keys, which is what we're so used to seeing in documentaries. But so the names don't stick as well, as you know, I'm just not great with names in general, but yes. Anyway, your question was I forgot my point and then remembered his Morris's documentary on Stephen Hawking, which is a follow-up to this one, A Brief History of Time. In the credits it says interviews listed by in order of appearance, and then it's a person's name, and next to it is the most memorable quote that they say in the and I just thought that was such an interesting way to credit people in a documentary, and I think probably the most accurate way to do it. And that's how I found out who people's names were, because I was like, oh, I remember that quote, and I remember that quote, and that's the person who it was. So yeah, you are about to use the description style, and Errol Morris, I believe, supports it.
Yeah, no, that's super interesting, because I think this movie, it doesn't employ that technique, but it's definitely all about memory forming very organically and not so much a straightforward linear narrative, in the way that in the first 10 minutes of this movie, I think, is basically split nearly down the middle, telling the same story twice, mm-hmm. but from different perspectives of different things happening. But what I want to know about... the Emily Miller character and the way they presented her, is that's the one where she's talking about how she used to be a detective, or used to think about being a detective, and they splice in some of that old footage. I think it's called Boston Blackie, is the detective movie that is kind of intercut there. Mm-hmm. What did you think of that technique? Do you think that's is that cheap? I mean, it's obviously not footage that's entirely relevant to the story. It's relevant to what she's talking about. But if we're going to dissect this movie in the way that you said, you know, he's applying these narrative film techniques to a documentary, can we talk about how, you know, he used that to form our opinions, and if that's fair? Because I think this movie is about someone getting kind of a raw deal about something that actually took place. Mm-hmm. And I feel that what is... kind of so unique about this is that he's doing the same thing he's criticizing. So I just want to feel free to use other examples, but I want to get your thoughts on that.
I guess I haven't thought about it so much, because we're just at this point, I'm used to documentaries just using whatever they can find to help their story. And you are right that sort of sticks out. And there's that Stephen Hawking documentary that I mentioned, that's his follow-up to this, does the same thing with episodes of like a Star Trek or something. But I mean, I can't say it bothers me, because I think that there's such a small... I feel like this is like such a... The Thin Blue Line, the thing that really grabs me about it, is just the use of storytelling techniques, and storytelling techniques that are, I think, like at least halfway between documentary and or traditional documentary and actual fiction, like film clip that you're discussing, that I feel like it kind of flows, and it also works because this is a character who the film leads us to believe is making things up. So I think it sort of plays with the placement, like where this clip is played, you know? And so I think I don't have a problem with it, is the short answer.
Like, if he took footage of like Dudley Do-Right or some bumbling cop and played it against just some cop he disagrees with, who seemed genuinely interested in doing his job properly but just got something wrong, you would draw a line there. Like, that's the difference.
Yeah, I mean, I would want to like see this version before I like properly diagnose how I feel about it, but yeah, I think it works specifically because of who it's underneath, and that we just, most viewers of this movie probably have an opinion about that character. I mean, we keep saying character, but you know, it's kind of the way that they're yeah. Pitched to us in this movie. We kind of have an opinion about her that falls in line with the idea of fabrication, and it's also even more so than most people in this film. Our opinions on her are become pretty obvious pretty quickly, whereas most people throughout the movie, it's more, you need to hear them speak more than once to sort of form their opinion. But like with her and the guy that has total recall and then immediately misremembers like 8 different details, those are,
it was so little confidence too. He's like, so I'm good. Sure it was this, or was it this? No, that's not what I'm sure me.
Well, I think what you can, in that case, I think what you can see happening in his head is him realizing, oh, these are documented facts. Like when he has total recall over something that's not documented, like via police reports, yeah. He would just say this and be like, oh yeah, that was a tan Ford. It's fine. But like just in conversation, and then someone's like, no, I'm pretty sure it was this. And you'd be like, no, I have total recall. Just a normal conversation, but with
that's written down and this is being recorded.
Exactly. So. Exactly. So I think that's what's tripping him up there. And I mean, the short answer is he does not have total recall, obviously, but yeah, with characters like that, like we just pretty quickly, we have our mind made up about how we feel about them. Whereas, I think are the two at the center of the movie, Adams and Harris, like, takes us a little bit longer to sort of decide how we feel about each of them. I mean, it may not take long in a lot of people's cases, but it definitely takes longer than it does for those two people that we've talked about. Yeah.
I would argue that with Emily Miller, I think we have our minds made up extra quickly because of the way she's framed.
Yeah. Okay. Do you mean like framed, like how the story, I don't forget how she's introduced, but there is like an instance of somebody talking about her before she appears on camera. I recall that, but I don't recall what the actual footage is that we see in front of her.
They talk about her and having, I think it's shortly after that, but they talk about how, you know, they would have made this up for the money. You know, they would have just claimed to have seen something, but even
that woman that calls them scum.
Yeah, and then tries to find a better word for scum and simply can't because it's too appropriate. I'm kind of two minds because I agree with, she kind of occupies a unique spot in that kind of meta representation of her through those edits do make more sense with her more than anybody except maybe her boyfriend. But even her is a little more so. But I think that we'd get there eventually, but I think there's something disingenuous about the shortcut that he takes by immediately having her undercut like that.
Okay.
And that's one thing that I love about the intro is that they kind of give you the two sides quickly, and you kind of know what you're up against and that you have a chance to spend whatever this movie is, you know, the next 90 minutes parsing it and looking at these two people's stories and coming up with what you believe. Mm-hmm. And I think almost everybody reaches the same conclusion, and I think the fact that this was seen by someone in Texas and overturned a year later leads me to believe that this is just an example of a story that is pretty clearly a miscarriage of justice. But
yeah, and by the end of the film, it is a very pointed opinion piece without somebody specifically saying, this is what I believe.
Yeah, exactly. I think that bit of manipulation, I think in that instance, is a little too much, but I think it's hard to draw the line because I think what makes this so valuable is that he employs that form of storytelling. And I don't know, I'm just a bit ambivalent because it's obviously manipulative. Like there's just no denying that he is using some unfair techniques that wouldn't fly in a court of law. Now, I mean, cinema is not the court of law and there's very important distinctions between the two. But I just didn't know if you ever thought like the music or the costumes or anything is too subjective.
No, because I just sort of like, again, the thing that draws me to this movie are so many of those choices. Like, I mean, it cannot be a coincidence that Adams is wearing a white shirt throughout this entire movie, you know? And,
and all the cops have like blue lines on their ties.
Yeah, no, exactly. And, I mean, in general, like he's just using such like, there's a high con, the footage, both in the reenactments and the interviews is just so high contrast to the point where it feels like they're pushing the film a stop or two, which is a technique that was probably used in a lot of noir movies and is still used, like PTA still pushes stops, which it just increases the contrast. It makes your really brights really even brighter, like your highlights, and it also makes your darks a little bit darker, just sort of creates more of a contrast. And there's just such a strong contrast in every shot of this this movie in a way that is kind of unnatural, and I think again heightens it. And the music again heightens it, and all of these cinematic techniques are the reason why when I watch most documentaries at the end of it, I'm like, cool, that was good. And when I watch The Thin Blue Line at the end of it, I thought to myself, I will watch every single thing that person makes because it's amazing. Yeah. And it's so speaks to like a type of unanswerable question that I love, thinking about, which is the line between reality and fiction, and how fictions can sort of can infect reality, as they do here. Like there are many fictions infecting the reality of Adam's life. And I think the way that this story is told does a really good job, and the way that Morris tends to tell his stories, it does a really good job of presenting us with people, presenting us with what these people think without giving us too many specific pointers of how we should think about people, think about them, before we actually hear their words. And I just sort of think that there is no straight line down the middle of this movie, despite the fact that the title is The Thin Blue Line. Like it's just so muddied all throughout, and we just spend the beginning of the movie, if you don't know anything about the case, first time I watched it, I didn't know which person was actually guilty. I knew one person was convicted wrongly, but you get a few minutes before you figure out which one that is. So, yeah. You know, you sort of have enough time to sort of take a guess. But yeah, at the beginning of the movie, you're just thrown into these shots of Dallas, and it's just like, okay, it's Thanksgiving. He's got a job. It's Saturday. Nobody's there. Why didn't he think about that? Anyway, all these things, and just the way it sort of draws you in without giving you any, it's November, it's 1976. We're in Dallas. It just tells you all of those things, but it tells you those things in a way that other documentaries don't do. There's no Dallas 1976 title card. There's no shot of a calendar before an event happens. There's no name key under Adams when he first appears, even though his name is on his shirt. So that's a bad example. But Harris, the same thing. And I don't know, just getting all of this information without any sort of hand-holding. You don't get told... You don't even get like orientated to be like, this is a cop. You know very quickly that this is a cop, but there's no, you know, police officer and then comma Dallas County under a person's name, you know, which I think affects a documentary so much. And it's a technique I'm shocked that more filmmakers haven't picked up. Maybe I just don't watch enough documentary films, but I just think it adds a level of intrigue to your storytelling that, I don't know. I'm surprised Morris hasn't been more influential than he is.
Yeah, we talk. I mean, he'd be one of the biggest documentary filmmakers. I mean, Michael Moore, Morgan Spurlock are just so contemporary that I think they'd be on the tip of most people's tongues.
Well, yeah, and I think one thing that I found really interesting about this movie is that how many like really famous documentaries don't have an engaging personality carrying you through the film, like you're talking about, like Morgan Spurlock, Supersize Me being his film that's most notable, Fahrenheit 9/11 or Roger and Me for Michael Moore.
Columbine?
Oh, yeah. Bowling for Columbine, yeah, is obviously the better example than Fahrenheit. And even something like Man on Wire, I forget the guy that did The Walk, what his name was. But he carries that movie through his personality. And when you see that movie, you remember that person, you know? And so many documentaries are defined by the engaging personalities in them. And the personality of The Thin Blue Line is the filmmaking, because nobody is all that engaging, you know? It's all how these voices are twisted. And twisted is kind of gives it a negative connotation, but that's what you do in editing is you take a variety of, say, transcripts, and I don't know how they edited documentaries at the time. I would imagine it was a lot of transcript manipulation initially before you actually had to cut the film. Now it's just, you know, you just watch the footage and move it around. But yeah, it's manipulating to the point where Morris gives a film a personality. Morris and his style of working gives the film a personality that in this case it just doesn't have, like, on camera.
Yeah. No, I agree. I think that you feel bad for Adams, obviously, because
of course
he's gone through something horrible. And you know he feels he's innocent. But I agree, like, there's no one that compelling here, you know? Mm-hmm. Adams isn't, you know, begging for forgiveness or so certain and, like, constantly. I mean, and maybe this has just been edited out, but that kind of just lines up with your point even more. So, like, we don't get this version of someone who you feel so badly for that you want to make sure something happens. And Harris isn't so evil. I mean, he's done a ton of terrible things. I just mean, even by the time we get to his confession, he's not this calculating mm-hmm. monster, right? Yeah. You know, he's like, I was a kid and my dad was a piece of shit and I saw an opportunity and I took it and, you know, tons of bad things happened and I was responsible for them. And so, again, you don't empathize with him either, but you just it's hard to really kind of, you know, die on that hill of that person being the worst person that you've ever come across, right?
Mm-hmm. They're both very, like, they're on-camera personality. I would describe both of them as numb. You know, like you, if, say, I had to interview a person like that on camera, like, I would shake their hand and immediately be like, oh, this interview is not going to be good. You know, like, it's just,
yeah,
this person just won't feel 100% comfortable on camera, won't give me a ton of energy, all these things. And that's exactly what we're talking about, is that the lack of personality in these films, key personalities.
Yeah. Yeah. No, and then I think it's a good way that you stated it, like, that the compelling personality is more the form of this than the substance.
Yeah. And, something that I was watching an interview with, Errol Morris, and, for anybody that doesn't know, if you want to go on a YouTube deep dive about Errol Morris, it is very easy and very enjoyable. It's just, like, I could listen to him talk. He's got that, like, Steven Soderbergh sort of like a filmmaker whose work I love, but who I also like listening to talk about basically anything.
Whose interviews might be better.
Exactly. And again, Steven Soderbergh might be my favorite filmmaker of all time, right. but might rather read an interview.
And throw some Werner Herzog stories into the mix.
Their relationship is great. Also, I think we should point it out now, like, Gates of Heaven, his first film in Vernon, Florida, which has its own fantastic story and was initially called Nub City. Are you familiar with this film at all?
I know.
Enough. Okay, but anyway, specifically his two earliest films really feel like they set the mold for Christopher Guest movies. And for that alone, Errol Morris deserves forever props. a quote about The Thin Blue Line that he said in an interview with Bill Moyers a couple of years after The Thin Blue Line came out. I think this is right after Adams got freed. Errol Morris summed up The Thin Blue Line by saying, I wanted to make a movie about how truth is difficult to know, not how truth is impossible to know. And I hope I've succeeded in that end. And I think that's, like, a perfectly, I'm going to dance around this question sort of answer, but also perfectly describes The Thin Blue Line, because I think The Thin Blue Line dances around a lot of questions. And again, since there is no voiceover or a very minimal text on screen, it's basically just at the very end, just summing up where these people are now. There's very little, like, pushing you in a direction, specifically pushing you in a direction throughout the movie, that it just sort of just feels like this just organism that exists and you have to form your own opinion on it. And I think the fact that it is specifically a story that where truth matters so much and what happened matters so much and the justness or lack thereof of what happened matters so much. I think it's just a perfect match for the things that Morris is interested in, has proven to be interested in throughout the rest of his career. And I mean, I can't imagine any history where this isn't his career highlight.
Yeah. Well, but I think, and I'm still kind of two minds on this. And I think a lot of people kind of have similar feelings, is that this is a quest. This is a movie so much about truth. And, you know, you kind of say it's this organism that doesn't push you one way or the other. But I think that what made this stand out so much at the time is that it was trying to push somebody one way or the other. Mm-hmm. And okay, so I'll take kind of a bigger step back than that, is it just because it's also a great story of the way that this was marketed. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, the poster says a softcore movie, Dr. Death, a chocolate milkshake, a nosy blonde, and the Carol Burnett show. Solving this mystery is going to be murder. Mm-hmm. I can imagine not the poster Errol Morris designed for this.
I mean, if we want to go through the list of posters designed by Harvey Weinstein that the film, because this is a Miramax film, yeah. And this was at a time where Miramax was even before, like, this is Miramax before Miramax, that we would come to know it. They were specifically built around documentaries and re-releasing British films to America. And just in general, it was very much exclusively, there wasn't so much art being created as it was being marketed by Miramax. And yeah, so what you're saying is a perfect example of Harvey Weinstein's very sensationalist way of promoting the movies that Miramax had to release.
Yeah, and that was when he was, like, as you said, kind of more just a huckster. Like, this was more of a PR machine than a mm-hmm. production company, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And it's a couple years after that when they start to become the Miramax that we would know. You know, I mean, Reservoir Dogs is their first, like, huge movie. Sex Lies and Videotape is a big one as well. But, we're still a few years away from Miramax proper, and we're still in Miramax the distributor, you know, exclusive distributor.
Yeah, and so I kind of just want to walk this line a bit and see where you can draw a line in the sand. Harvey Weinstein listening to Errol Morris on NPR saying, you know, I thought your interviews were boring. You have to kind of sell this movie as a highly thrilling emotional experience, and like trying to make it look more like a thriller or a horror movie than it is, you know, this very kind of quiet and slow paced documentary. Even telling Errol Morris to use shorter and clearer sentences, which, if you know anything about Errol Morris, is not his style at all.
No.
And so this was a movie that, like, was disqualified for the documentary category in the Academy Awards because of too much scripted content. And, you know, as you said, they have this music, they have this kind of constant use of costuming that's meant to, you know, sway you one way or the other. And by one way or the other, I mean the one way that Errol Morris wants you to feel about this, which probably is the truth. So I just kind of have to push back on this as being kind of something that's just put out there and to let you read into, when it really does seem to have, you know, a right answer, like a right reading to it, if you were to talk to Errol Morris after you saw this movie.
Yeah, no, I agree with that. I think my argument is that, I mean, we brought up Michael Moore earlier. There's no scene at the very beginning where he's like, guns suck and this is why, you know, like, it's more... It's kind of the Thin Blue Line sort of approaches this story from a perspective that, you know, Errol Morris's perspective most pointedly, but the way that it gets you to the conclusion is just more subtle than so many styles of documentary. And you know, I do not like handholding in my filmmaking. And
you like handheld, but not handled.
Yeah, I like handheld when it's done the right way. Saw a lot of bad handheld camera work in a movie I watched yesterday. I just think that the lack of a consistent voice carrying us through this movie and continually writing the ship of where we're going or the direction that we're going, I think that is what sort of allows me to believe and agree. I believe in and agree with Errol Morris's point about the truth and the impossibility of knowing truth. And I, again, another thing I like so much about this movie and the way that it sort of presents these facts to us is the way that the first reenactment is presented. It's, you know, we just get the those brief introductions to Adams and Harris, and the last thing we hear is Adam before the first like proper reenactment of the actual crime in question. We hear him say something like, you know, I just happened to run out of gas, whatever.
Listing why, all the things that yeah, had to happen. Yeah.
Why
yeah.
did I meet this kid? Why did I run out of gas at this time? I don't know, but it happened. And then we get to our first reenactment. And the first reenactment of the actual crime is very similar to how you would basically, it's like if somebody went through a news report from the day after the murder and made a reenactment there. There's no inclusion of the malt, you know, the flying malt and the other officer's involvement in the case. It's just a very, this human being was murdered. and this is what happened. This is what we know. And we know very little. So we've got a police car stopping another car. We've got that police officer getting murdered. We've got a second police officer shooting at the car. And then we've just got some shots from the autopsy report, Woods' autopsy report, shot of Woods the person, which would likely be included in that newspaper story anyway. And just, again, just a very sort of journalistic presentation. The next time we get a reenactment, things differ. We get new information because, to my recollection, this is from the law enforcement side of things. And a lot of it focuses on, I believe it's Officer Turco is the name of the woman, and her involvement and the way that she didn't follow procedure, the things that she didn't remember. And just as we get like different parts of the story, we see the sort of fiction aspects from those different perspectives. And I know Errol Morris pushes back on the idea that this is a Rashomon-style filmmaking, but I do find it really interesting that we get a handful of these reenactments tied to different perspectives, you know, the journalistic perspective, the law enforcement perspective, what have you. But we never get the one that Errol Morris actually believes, which is that Harris was alone in the car and killed Officer Woods. And I think that's sort of, again, that's something that you don't think about when you're watching the movie, but once you hear that, you're like, oh yeah, that is right. That you don't get, like, there's no final summation after that tape recorder of like, here's one last reenactment and this is what happened, and like a face comes through the shadow or whatever, you know, which would have made me break my television probably.
Like when they show the big art attack from above and you can see the
whole time. Do not drag art attack into this. I'm surprisingly pro art attack. Give it everything you know about me as a human being. But I think that's the sort of the difference of opinion we have there on the unknowable truth is that Errol Morris believes that, but he also believes that he can't say with 100% certainty, so he's not going to include that that final reenactment, which is what he actually believes and what the perspective of this film is trying to get us to believe. But he won't go the whole way of actually being like, this is it. Whereas I think a lot of other documentaries would you know, it's a totally different style, so reenactments wouldn't be in the question, but would tell you specifically what they want you to think at the end of the film a lot of times, you know?
Yeah, like if Michael Moore handled different subjects and say, like, to use your example, if he had a JFK theory, mm-hmm. there would be like a 6-minute run through of everything he believes by the end of it, right?
Yeah, exactly. For sure. Yeah. I think that would be the end of his JFK movie.
No, you know what? I will agree with that. Yeah, I think that is an important distinction to make, too. But I do kind of want to continue to go through the reenactments.
Yeah, happy.
Kind of like under a microscope because, you know, sometimes I'll watch anything for this podcast and then research it and be surprised by how people received it or viewed something differently. And the reenactments was something that I thought was done in a very visually interesting way,
mm-hmm.
Which we've talked about already, you know, the colors and the kind of juxtaposition between the whites and the blacks,
yeah,
and things like throwing the malt out the window and stuff, yeah, like that.
And I suspect the reenactments were shot on 35 millimeter while the interviews were shot on 16 millimeter. So it's just a higher quality of film. So it makes them pop even more.
Okay, because and this sounds, I'm just going to admit, this sounds very dumb on my initial viewing. I mean, I'd seen this movie years before, but just watching it again for this. And just, I also watch or read about, like, murder trials and things like that, in the way that you can kind of sway a jury or sway somebody by showing a reenactment, and just seeing it one time through, even knowing it's just a reenactment or a hypothetical reenactment, or, you know, the prosecution's belief on what took place, really can skew people's opinions about history. And, you know, showing somebody a video of something and you're saying this never happened, then asking them 6 months later if it happened, that's just a powerful way to do things. Like, having seen something, it really can affect your memory, even if you watch it knowing it never took place.
Mm-hmm.
So watching these reenactments, they seemed so low-key to me. They seemed to be, like, so unstylized and so undramatic, because the way that they were cut up, it wasn't this continuous shot of Woods getting out of the car and then, you know, the gunshots and people running and the car speeding away all in one smooth motion, which I imagine is what your memory of that event would be like if you were Teresa Turco or anyone who drove by or pretended to drive by at that moment. And so when I was watching it, I was kind of loving how not stylized it was, and that it wasn't leaving this big impression on the viewer. You know, it was slightly slower. It didn't look like reality in any way that was going to be confused with your real memories of something, and that lack of verisimilitude I kind of respected as someone trying to posit these as hypotheticals and not sway your opinions, right?
Yeah.
But in reading about it, people really disliked these reenactments and saying that the way that it's stylized, it has this, like, noir element to it, and that it's, like, kind of sexied up, and that it wins you over in a way that it doesn't make you think it's reality, but it has, like, this certain veneer and the certain, like, glitz and sexiness to it that it wins you over in a different kind of underhanded way. And that was just kind of something that I've been dealing with since watching it and then reading about it and then hearing Morris talk about this in relation to film noir and the use of shadows and white and black was something that I just admittedly was so, I totally took the other way. I took this as something really dry and innocuous, and other reviewers and even Morris himself seems to say that there was a lot of style on this and that this is, like, nothing but flash. So I didn't know where you came down on that, because I see that milkshake flying through the air and I think, like, it's cool that there's not a picture of some dead cop in the background to, you know, tug on my heartstrings. But some people think, yeah, you know, that's this millimeter of film and there's the film stop and all these other things that I'm just not as perceptive of, someone who's not fully in tune with all those visual elements. So I want to ask you, as someone who is more in tune with that kind of stuff, if you see that as underhanded or just stylish or just kind of way to shake things up, or where you land on that.
I definitely don't think it's underhanded. I agree with you that, like, the first time watching this movie, and still, like, it feels to me like these are the most stylish, this is the most stylish way you could stage these reenactments on a budget. Because I cannot imagine they had a lot of money to shoot these reenactments. And
Errol Morris says he lost money on this.
Yeah. Well, yeah, exactly. But I mean, that doesn't really give us an indication of really how much specifically that they're spending and how much of that money was his money.
You're not saying Harvey Weinstein would rip him off, would you?
But it's like, you know, because they use darkness so much and spotlights and stuff like that. And there, you really don't see, like, the, like, there's no wide shot where you see a lot of different things happening simultaneously, you know? And
it's like one, you see a bottom lip and a straw.
Yeah, exactly. So, but they're really well composed. There's just not, there's not a ton of shots, and we hold on them for a long time. And the editing is not fast paced by any means. Whereas I think, you know, when you think about a movie that tries to up the level of excitement in a very, you know, just in a very simple way, they would just edit it faster. You know, they'd add more cuts, and it just sort of, again, it just makes your brain resettle again on this new image every time you do a cut. And The Thin Blue Line, I think one of the strengths of it is that it doesn't do that. And it presents these very stylized sort of images that, The camera doesn't move very much. You get some zooms on some license plates, and that's like the fastest cut sequence of the movie. Once we start talking about Turco being hypnotized and the police thinking that was like that was expensive but worth it, quote unquote. That's that sequence is like as fast paced as the editing in this movie gets, and it's really engaging, but it's still like relatively slow paced, all things considered. And I think that. To go back to the idea of people saying this is too stylized and all that, I think those are very 1980s opinions, in that this just like, this wasn't done too much, you know? And, if at all, and something that was an actual documentary. And so I think those are coming out of a place of, you know, if somebody, if say the modern day, this generation's Errol Morris put out a movie tomorrow that had some new technique that I had never thought about before. Neither of us had ever thought about before. And it was just like something that was just like on the line of something I believe in or not. I would probably be on this sort of old side of being like, oh, it's, you know, the
that's
modern day
exploitative. Equivalent.
Exactly. Whereas now it's just like, I was two when this movie came out. I've lived a life, pretty much entirely post The Thin Blue Line and The Thin Blue Line's influence. So it's hard to comment on it. And I think that the best way to sort of describe the difference between what you're reading and how people our age actually feel about it is just a lifetime lived before The Thin Blue Line, which we just do not have, you know?
Yeah. And
I don't think the stylization is disrespectful in any way. I think it's a way, I mean, I think anytime a documentary is made about an incident as serious as this, as Adams having 11 or 12 years of his life taken away from him, of Officer Woods having his life taken away from him, sensitive issues involving Turco and, you know, her life after this incident, how it must have been affected. Like, we don't really get her story. But just all of these, like, very, you know, these very serious issues, like, I that's something that I always feel a little bit like weird about with documentary, because I think anytime you're making a documentary about something like this, you are always kind of using people for their story in some way. And, you know, if Officer Woods doesn't die, this movie doesn't get made, you know? And so, like, the catalyst for this movie is a human being dying, you know? So I always feel like it's a tricky subject to talk about from our perspective. It's very tricky to I can only imagine to make a movie about this and treat specifically Officer Woods with the proper amount of respect to also delve into other things involved in the story. And I think it's always tricky. And so I can totally see how somebody would think that the stylization of those reenactments sort of could be disrespectful in some way or over the top, exploitive, to use your word. I just sort of feel like that's a given going into a movie about something like this, you know?
Yeah, and I kind of see a straight line. Like, it was 2008, I think, Waltz with Bashir won Best Documentary, and that was animated.
Yep, that movie's awesome.
yeah, and Mouse, the graphic novel or book, you know, super highly stylized, but Spiegelman's, you know, recollections of, you know, a concentration camp and what it was like to live through the Holocaust. And these, you know, with that last one, especially, pretty much the heaviest topic that you can come up with.
Mm-hmm.
And treat it in kind of a cutting edge way with, you know, a new form, but handled properly and respected. It's new and different. It kind of takes a bit of time to get your head around, but it's just a developing art form, right?
Yeah, exactly. I think Persepolis, is the film came out around the same time, and is less documentary than Waltz with Bashir, but it kind of fits into what you're talking about with Mouse. Exactly. It's just every once in a while, there's a new way to tell a story. And every time there's something new, there's going to be older people that are like, I don't know about this. This feels kind of exploitative. And one day that'll be us. And
this ain't a beer drinking movie.
Yeah, exactly. we'll go to one of those poor boy specials, $2.50 a carload, and we'll get all riled up about the exploitative decisions. I mean, we haven't talked about the music too much, and I think it's extremely important.
You know what? Coming off that, I'll redact that all I said about the music so far is that it was exploitative.
I'm curious to know what you feel about the music in general, about this movie, in this movie.
I think it's good, and I think it's interesting. I think it's a nice little motif, like the central part of it, just...
Yeah.
Purely from a musical standpoint. I put this kind of in the first category of things we were talking about of, just kind of tugging on your heartstrings in a way that I don't think documentaries always do or always should do.
Mm-hmm.
I think that the real way, like with something you were kind of getting at earlier, and I think one of the things that I always see about this movie is that, people love to take a postmodernist angle to this and say, you know, this flattens the idea of truth and that there is no objectivity and that, you know, there's this question of truth that pervades it, but we never quite get to the bottom of it. And just the way that I've been pushing back on some of the things you're saying, like I push back on that. If it were a bit more ambivalent, if they applied those techniques to both sides of the story, I think I'd be more receptive to that reading of it.
Mm-hmm.
And so with this music question in particular, like I just find it only shows up at times when we're supposed to sympathize. And you know, you can say that about certain words and certain filmic techniques, that they're used, you know, either properly or exploitatively, depending on how you want to look at it. I don't think that there's a ton of place for that kind of music within documentary.
Mm-hmm.
And so I will say that in a vacuum, I like this music, mm-hmm. but in applied theory, I don't think it's wise.
Okay. I mean, I guess I disagree, because I like one of the things I like about this music is that specifically the theme, it kind of doesn't have a resolution. It's just the same thing repeated over and over again. And I don't feel like there is a specific emotion that I get from this music. I certainly get the feeling that this is good music, and I tend to I mean, not every time Philip Glass has scored a movie, because I think he's credited on the 2015 Fantastic Four movie as a composer. But, you know, like his movies with Godfrey Reggio, the Koyaanisqatsi movie and trilogy, and Visitors are very, like, beloved films in my brain. And his music is so important to these things. But I guess I'm going to, like, say two conflicting things. Like, because the thing I enjoy about... his music and the music specifically in this film is that there isn't really a resolution to it. It's repetitive. You know, the same 15 minutes of music is used so frequently throughout the movie. And I don't feel like it is, quote unquote, tugging at my heartstrings. I feel like it sounds like, the process of re-examining something over and over in my head musically. And the Philip Glass scores that I tend to really appreciate sound that way. They're repetitive and they're gorgeous, But again, it just feels like thinking about the same idea over and over again, which I think really sums up the thing I like about this movie is, again, thinking about the same story repeatedly with new pieces of information or new tellings of different aspects of the story, and then sort of coming to your conclusion, the 99% of the time coming to the same conclusion as Errol Morris. I also think, and going to what you're saying, I'm like so confident Philip Glass deserves way more credit for Adams getting out of jail, because I think Errol Morris makes this movie without Philip Glass's involvement or without a similar musician or composer taking the lead with the music. Like, I think Adams is still in jail. I think that's a huge part of the success of this movie, is just that thing, that hook that stays in your head. And I was just walking around the other day, not listening to anything, and just it had been a few days since I'd watched this movie, and just that those notes come back into my head, and it's just like, it's very catchy. But I feel differently in that I feel the music is emotionless, but I also feel like it's so important to the movie. And I don't know, just another way we differentiate, I suppose. You know? The truth is impossible to get to, I guess.
No. I mean, I'll try to parse this a bit. Like, it still has a ton of gravity to it without being like saccharine, like overly sweet, it's like, this is heavy, but place this weight wherever you want it, sort of.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, we've talked about the importance of music and the ability of music to sway an audience. It's become an overused example to just say any John Williams score, you know, and or almost any John Williams score. But I think the most recent example of this is the trailer for Won't You Be My Neighbor, which is the documentary about Mr. Rogers. I've seen that trailer like 10 times, maybe even more than that, in theaters. And like every time, it uses this song called Fish Beach, which is by Michael Nyman. It's used repeatedly in Man on Wire, which was like, why do I know this? Why do I know this? And eventually sort of remembered Man on Wire, which, again, another documentary that owes so much to Errol Morris. Lots of reenactments in that film. But the Won't You Be My Neighbor trailer, like, it's a really good trailer, but it's entirely carried by this beautiful piece of music. And at the end of every single time I've seen that trailer, you can hear people sniffling. Like, it's just, it just gets people. And coincidentally, one of the podcasts we've talked about music being so important, like, I believe you asked me, like, is Gattaca a good movie, or is the score just perfect, or whatever, you know? Or do you just like the score? The score for Gattaca is done by Michael Nyman, who also did Fish Beach, and in general does Philip Glass style music. So I've always sort of paired them in my head. And I just sort of think that music is something that can affect a viewer's opinion so strongly in ways that they might not realize, because I don't think the people that are crying in the Won't You Be My Neighbor trailer are thinking Michael Nyman is doing this to me. It's Mr. Rogers entirely, you know, in the way that these clips of Mr. Rogers are being juxtaposed. But I believe wholeheartedly it is the doing of Fish Beach and Fish Beach exclusively. And when I actually saw that movie, I thought Fish Beach would have been a much stronger closer than using it early in the movie that like they did. I just in general think music is super important, and I think Philip Glass deserves more credit for the overturning, despite the fact that he did infinitely less work than Errol Morris time wise. I think his work was probably just as important, you know, to get this movie and help this movie stay in the collective heads of its viewers.
Yeah, and I to talk about that kind of ambiguity to music, and you know, knowing that there's something it kind of wrenches people's heart about. I should feel something right now. And I think it's people who, you know, to further your example, may have not given a fuck about Mr. Rogers growing up, but watch that trailer and it still kind of resonates with them.
Yeah. Well, Mr. Rogers is a weird example because you have so many, like most people our age or older would have some sort of memory of Mr. Rogers so deeply like in the recesses of their brain that they just don't remember. And it's that one's specifically a hard subject to talk about because, you know, your experiences with Mr. Rogers often predate your memory, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway, sorry, I didn't cut you off. My apologies.
No, no, no. Just that this movie kind of rounds out with two people talking. I mean, it's not the finish after the, because that's the tape recorder, but the example of two people talking about Lady Justice and being blind and that immediate juxtaposition of these two people discussing this idea and how it affects their lives and, you know, who's responsible for these crimes. I think kind of ties into that idea of music, that there's just this weight and there's this gravity to it, and being put in that position, you kind of, everyone's kind of forced to look at the same facts and the same ideas and the same archetypes and just kind of plug in their values wherever they see fit. And I think that's one thing that I really do enjoy about this movie and about the way that it concludes, is that these are a ton of people who have so much riding on this.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, for everything I say about how Errol Morris does put his thumb on the scale and kind of sway the viewer one way or the other, it is very interesting to see these people take this same figure, the same metaphor, and skew it towards their own lives in strikingly different ways.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and I just, I don't know. I think the thing that makes to sum up our opinions on Errol Morris and just the casual disagreements we've been having is,
down for me.
No, just in general, I think, like, you know, I mean, this is our 321st episode or whatever. If you go back and listen through all of them consistently, you are going to end up on the side of substance and I will end up on the side of style so yeah. frequently. And I think there's an honesty to the style of filmmaking that Errol Morris has about documentary. And this is part of the reason why I'm just, as a film goer, I don't watch as many documentaries. And you know, the thing I always say is I get my nonfiction from books and my fiction from movies. But I like that Errol Morris exists in the in-between, and the way that he uses stylistic flair from like fiction movies with these reenactments, and specifically the use of music, I feel like those are almost sort of and those are things that you say are done in ways that sway the viewer's opinion and make it seem, you know, more pointed than any sort of postmodern reading of these films and their opinion on truth would have you feel. But I just sort of think that using these fiction aspects or narrative filmmaking aspects on a documentary feels like a more honest version of making a documentary to me. It feels yeah. like the version of how I feel like documentary should be treated in my head. Whereas just because, you know, so frequently you'll just have a conversation with somebody who watches a documentary and just assumes everything is 100% fact. And I like to believe that documentary filmmakers are rigorously researching everything, but I also just, I mean, the one thing I might 100% believe in the world is that you can't believe in anything 100%, you know? And as contradictory a thought as that might be, like, that's just how I feel about everything. Anytime I'm watching a documentary, I'm viewing the construction aspects that could have affected how I feel about this subject, how I feel about this filmmaker as well, because I'm always approaching it from that aspect. And that's the thing that I appreciate about Errol Morris, is that he's using all of these subjective things, as we've talked about, you know, the music, the reenactments, the way he dresses, the interview subjects, all of these things, but they're all subjective decisions that he's making, but they're all sort of subtly subjective, and he allows you to sort of figure these things out over the course of the film, or, you know, probably in your case within the first 5 minutes of being like, okay, he's pointing me in this direction. And I just sort of, but I think there's an honesty to that. I think there's an honesty to being upfront about the fact that anytime you do any form of long form journalism, or any sort of long form journalism like this is, or like a long Vanity Fair piece that you'll read about whatever, being inside Trump's White House or whatever, any sort of long form journalism in filmmaking or print has an element of storytelling to it, has an element of subjectivity to it. And it always bothers me when somebody approaches a documentary as being 100% objective, and I find it happens frequently. And I think this is something that I realized was a problem, or felt was a problem, before I had ever seen an Errol Morris movie too. So I think maybe when I saw an Errol Morris movie, I was specifically this one, I was like, oh, this is a documentary that's being totally honest about the fact that documentaries are subjective in some way, and he's presenting facts in a way that he feels they should be presented, but he's allowing me to sort of come to various conclusions about those facts, preferably the conclusions that he has also come to, which again, as I said, is pretty much the conclusion everybody comes to. But he's doing it in sort of this honest way that's also saying to me, yes, I'm making a documentary, but I also realized, and know that you realize this as well, that I'm swaying your opinion just in the process of storytelling, because that's just how storytelling works. You listen to a storyteller tell a story, and in this case, it's not like voiceover narration. It's not Michael Moore on screen. It's the filmmaking style, and I just find it to be a very subtly honest style that I think is something I really strongly respect, and just from a purely stylistic perspective, love watching for all of the reasons we have discussed.
Yeah, I think I like that version of it the best, is that it's not that he's being deceptive. It's that he's using kind of every tool that is at his disposal and respects you enough as a viewer to know that you are being swayed by these things, but you're aware of it.
Yeah, exactly. And like, this is 1988. Like, it's so crazy to me.
Yeah, no, like, I fully agree that we haven't really talked about how much of, like, we've talked that it was kind of ahead of its time and a product of its environment of all that, but this is well before that reasonably should be taking place.
Absolutely. I mean, like, this, the way this film is made, the style of it, everything, like, you know, if you removed all sorts of all of the indicators of time, you know, like the years, whatever, the Burger King logo, all of these things that really date it to 1988, and put out a modern day version of this movie tomorrow, if Errol Morris had just disappeared from the earth, and then this like new version of an Errol Morris movie just appeared that was exactly like the Thin Blue Line, it would still be revolutionary. Like, it's crazy. Like, I just think that's so mind-boggling, and I find him to be such an interesting figure and such an unbelievably talented filmmaker as well. And again, I've said it a million times, this is his masterwork in my eyes, you know. So but yeah, thanks for listening to The MacGuffin Man, and be sure to check back next time.